I'm going to do a few brief introductions, Council, before we begin. My notes tell me that we have students from Horning Middle School here with us this morning. If they are, will they and their advisors please stand? Oh, my, a fine group. Thank you very much. Please be seated. The students are here with our program that we operate in coordination with the State Bar of Wisconsin called for with class. So they've learned a little bit about the case that you are going to argue to us now. When this argument is over, Justice Annette Ziegler will come out and speak with you and perhaps some of the other students and anyone else who wants to attend. She certainly will welcome. She won't be talking about the case, but telling you a bit more about the Supreme Court and what goes on here and how cases get here. So if you can come back or if you can remain, all of that will be fine. I'd like to introduce all of the court to the students and others who are present this morning. On my far right is Justice Rebecca Bradley and Justice Ziegler, you've just said hello to. Next to me is Justice Shirley Abrahamson. I am Pat Rogensack, the Chief Justice. On my left, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. And after her, Justice Michael Gableman. And on the far left of the bench, Justice Daniel Kelly. So with those brief introductions, we are now ready to call our second case of the morning, Benson versus the City of Madison. And I can see you are ready to go.
I am. Thank you, Chief.
Okay, please.
Thank you, Chief Justice, fellow justices. My name is Kevin Palmersheim. I represent the golf professionals who, through 2012, for a matter of decades, had managed and operated the City of Madison golf courses. What I hope to touch on today is three issues, the first of which is, given the package of goods and services that the golf pros were selling, were they considered to be selling something, goods or services, on behalf of the city so as to have the city have to comply with the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law? Secondly, if, as an alternative, given the fact that the pros had to contribute thousands of dollars annually to a joint advertising campaign under the city brand Golf Madison Parks, did they satisfy the advertising commercial symbol element of the Fair Dealership Law? And thirdly, is a Wisconsin city a person who can be subject to the dealership law? And the way I want to start is in terms of whether or not pros were selling something for the city. If we look at the contract itself, the first page of the contract, and this one I'm looking at is the Benson contract, but they're all pretty much substantially identical. The city is engaged in the operation and maintenance of the public facility called Odana Golf Course and desires to engage a competent and qualified golf professional to operate, manage, and provide certain services at Odana Golf Course. That is what we're talking about in terms of the dealership here. The operation, management, and provision of services to the public.
I wonder, Council, when I was reading your brief, and especially the, I can't remember what it was called, the Happy Meal analogy, I guess, the hamburger and meal deal, I wondered to myself, why are they going this far? Why are they trying to make it sound like it has to be some sort of package? It almost seemed to me like you were adding an element. When I look to the second element of whether a dealership exists under 135.023A sub 2, the contract by which a person is granted, subpart small a, the right to sell goods or services, and you were criticized for the package approach, obviously, in the response brief from the city. But my question to you is, why isn't it enough, from your perspective, your client's perspective, to say, yes, we were selling access to the golf course, and without making the argument that it has to be some kind of package experience? You know, my dad, who's 90 years old, but still plays golf a couple times a week. Norb Gableman doesn't usually stop at the pro shop to pick up golf balls or or at the, you know, he's got enough golf balls.
Mm-hmm.
He goes and he pays his greens fees or he pays his membership and he goes to play. Why the package deal? Why the emphasis?
Justice Gableman, I do think it's enough. And I think I had a difficult time with the lower courts in trying to persuade them. But I think you've hit it on the head. The second element talks about the right to sell goods and services. What I think part of the confusion is, if you look at some of the case law, they start confusing a little bit, especially the Court of Appeals case law, the analysis of community of interest with that element of selling goods. And I think here you've hit it on the head, is they have the right and obligation to sell the greens fees, seasons, passes. Right there, I think the golf pros have satisfied that element, and then we move the court on
Counsel,
to community of interest.
Yes. If that's sufficient, then tell me how this would differ from a much more prosaic situation. Let's say a property manager for an apartment complex. Property manager is selling access to the apartments and is passing along the collecting and passing along the rent to the owners. How is that different from what you just explained there?
It's different on the community of interest analysis because under the Ziegler analysis for community of interest, you need both.
Yeah, okay, and I'm interested in that. But I just want to, you had mentioned in response to Justice Gableman's question that it was sufficient that the golf pros are selling access to the golf courses. That was sufficient to create a dealership. So I just want you to concentrate on that and compare that to the property manager of an apartment complex.
That's sufficient to satisfy that particular element of selling goods and services. Perhaps, you know, your analogy, I would have to know more about it, but if you're selling as a property manager, selling space in a building and the space belongs to the landlord, conceivably you could satisfy that element. You wouldn't satisfy any of the other elements to create a dealership.
Right. Your point is well made. Your response went to the second element of what creates a dealership, but then you read the conjunction and then we go into the community of interest. And obviously all three of these things, no one's argued the first because the existence of the contract is self-evident. But the Court of Appeals, I wonder what your take on the Court of Appeals, in particular the section in the Court of Appeals opinion where it referred to the idea of selling access to a golf course as abstract. I was struck by the use of that adjective to describe it. It doesn't seem that abstract to me. People don't talk about, I'm going to temporarily rent a space on a golf course so that I can play 9 or 18 holes or more. They talk about buying or paying for greens fees. They talk about buying a round of golf. They talk about paying for a round of golf. Why, and I didn't take the time to think about the phrase that the Court of Appeals used within the entire context of their opinion, but what did you make of that, their characterization of that as an abstract concept?
I think when you read the Court of Appeals opinion, I mean, they start off their opinion talking about the concern over whether a city can be sued, which I thought was interesting because then they didn't decide the case on that. So it was almost as if they got hung up on that particular issue. On the abstraction issue, I think, to use an analogy that the city has used, they compare the golf pros to a ticket taker. Like at a movie theater.
Right, or amusement.
Right. Well, you know, first of all, to make that comparison, you'd have to say that the ticket taker was also buying all the popcorn, hiring all the ushers and projectionists, buying all the equipment to run the movies,
paying for the insurance and the workers' compensation.
Exactly.
But that gets into your community of interest.
Precisely. And on the selling goods, and in the contract itself, even if you reduce it to greens fees and season passes on that component, under the golf pros' duties, they have to, quote, employ attendants to sell and collect greens fees, resident and non-resident annual passports, and other established player promotional devices, renewals, and take and process reservations. This is the obligations imposed by the contract on these golf pros to sell these items.
So, I don't want to get in the way of the presentation of the rest of your argument, but I want to make clear my understanding of the undisputed facts include the notion that the city remained responsible for all maintenance on the golf courses?
Maintenance, yes. The holes in the greens and that type of maintenance. The pros maintained the or clean and did minor maintenance on the clubhouse itself.
I see. And then the contract required the purchase of a sufficient number of golf carts, motorized golf carts, to meet the demand of the public.
Correct.
All right.
Yes.
I wanted to make clear, where do those two things, especially the latter, the idea of the golf carts, I suppose, would your argument be that that falls under the third element, community of interest?
Yes, but I do think that that's also a good or service of the city, that they're saying that you need to have these golf carts available for golfers. That, the Court of Appeals also got hung up on the pros are selling their own services. But nobody is going to go out to that golf course and say, I want to rent a golf cart, but I don't want to golf.
Why I was thinking community of interest is because unlike the greens fees, 100% of which were passed through to the city, and the golf pros retained 0%, as I understand, of the greens fees, there was a percentage basis that was passed to the city on the club rentals and on the golf cart rentals. So it seems to me, now the city characterizes this as nothing more than, well, what's good for the city is good for the golf pros. I think it might be a little more nuanced than that. But why wouldn't that fall under community of interest? If they're required to pay, they're required to buy the golf carts. Not everybody who plays around a golf rents a golf cart. So
right.
the golf pros, it seems to me, I can't remember. Was that part of the 11% that goes to the city, or was that 15%?
The 15%, Your Honor. 11% was the food and beverage concession.
Okay. And so it seems to me that under the contract, the city imposes the requirement that a sufficient number, and there's nothing I saw on the record about a dispute ever being in place about not enough golf carts having been, but I imagine it's a lot of golf carts. There was no number in there, and motorized golf carts are not inexpensive. So it seems to me they have the burden to purchase and maintain the motorized golf carts, but then they bear the risk that people are they're just going to walk. And so I don't know why that doesn't fall under community of interest.
Well, and we believe that it does. And, in fact, the city has conceded that the golf carts themselves, the motorized golf carts, was a significant expense and investment for the golf pros. And if you look at the joint facts that were stipulated to for summary judgment, which is record number 63, fact 104 says the city's acknowledging that that's a significant expense. And as we know from some of the other cases, Bush, the photography case, Bush says that one of the ways you can establish community of interest, not the only way, but one of them, is a substantial investment.
And Bush invested, what was it, $150,000?
Well, he actually only invested $17,000 at the time of termination. He had bought his photography dealership from his father and agreed to pay him out of proceeds over a period of 10 or 15 years.
And the court in Bush also put some weight on the idea that Bush had extended credit to students who were unable to come up with the payment at the time. How do you think Bush fits into the analysis here?
Well, the important part is, and we do have to talk about the individual facts and compare some of the case law that we have and how those facts compare to the golf pros. But as the cases say, you got to step back and look at the totality of circumstances, and that's what Ziegler says. Look at the totality. You don't get isolated and hung up on facts. But if you do compare Bush, Bush is the only case that we have in the record that they actually paid money into advertising. The photographer in Bush paid 50% of the advertising costs for advertising these services to schools on taking pictures. Bush also could commit to the sale. You know, Bush was the one actually selling the product, going to the schools, selling the packages to the students. And that's different than the other cases, Kanya or Baki.
Well, I mean, how does Bush help or hurt you in this?
I think Bush does help. You know, when you look at those factors in Bush, you know, Bush not only was in the joint advertising, but it was a cooperative, coordinated effort in Bush. You know, Bush was the one that was making the sales, collecting the money, sending the proceeds on to National. Now, National actually shipped out the photo packages in that case to the schools. But, you know, Bush was on the front lines and was taking the money. And that's the same thing the golf pros were doing. Is they were taking the money. They had to remit that to the city on a weekly basis and account for it. They were committing the city to a sale. I don't understand this argument in the city's briefs. They're arguing that the golf pros had no authority to commit the city to a sale. And I don't know how that can be. The golf pros were the only people at all connected with the city that could commit a sale of greens fees and seasons passes.
Well, it might run to the argument that the contractual provisions included the prohibition on the golf pros from selling any city property. That was an express term of the contract. But of course, we have the case law that instructs us that we look not only to the language of the contract, but to the actual duties and responsibilities.
Yeah.
And so, I suppose if there's a city-owned lawnmower on the golf course left overnight by one of the maintenance crew, the sale of that would be prohibited by, among other things, the criminal law, but also the law of the contract. But in terms of selling access to the golf course, it seems that was their job.
Well, and there are contrary language in the agreement, but that they had to sell, so they do have the provision saying you're not selling goods and services, but then their obligation is to do that. And then if we look at the Bush case, you know, in Bush, the photographer was actually an employee, and there was withholding out of his wages over a period of 21 years. When he got terminated, there was unemployment compensation, and the court in Bush stated that employment relationship is not covered on the dealership law, but they didn't stop at the language of the contract where it says they're an employee. They looked at the whole circumstances of the relationship to determine whether a dealership existed.
Counsel, I have a question for you. Suppose there was only one golf course and only one contract. Would that still be a dealership?
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't yes. matter how many.
Right. It's the coordinated cooperative effort.
And then I get to really the question, which I think was underlying for Justice Kelly, but maybe not. What is the distinction between any service contract, the property manager, a company or companies that build prisons and manage prisons for the state? Schools under the same kind of management contracts. As I understand Ziegler and other cases, there is not a broad interpretation of dealership or liberal interpretation. Once you decide there's a dealership, then you liberally apply the provisions of the statute, as I understand the case law and the statute. Just when I read this, it struck me that if I put my head to it, I could think of dozens and dozens of contracts that are like this and that are handled every day in... You would put them under the dealership law.
I don't think there are dozens.
Okay. Well, what about the property management? You got property managers in the city of Madison that handle many, many buildings. And the contract would be you can rent out the space. There may be criteria for renting out the space, just like there might be criteria for you let on the golf course. provisions about advertising, there are provisions about who pays for what maintenance in the building, et cetera. And is that a franchise?
No.
Why not?
The dealership law doesn't only limit itself to franchises, but no, that would not be covered.
Okay, is that a dealership?
No, I don't think that's not a dealership.
Why not?
There is not both the continuing financial interest between the two.
Well, this is a contract that's gone, has a five-year period, and it's been renewed 10 times, just like this one. This is a long term.
Well,
these people are unhappy that they're being fired. I mean, I understand that, right?
Would you please complete your answer? I was interested in what you were saying. You said there's not a continuing financial interest in what else?
And not the interdependence that the Ziegler Court is talking about. So when you hire a property manager, you're hiring a property manager because you don't want to do it yourself. And you're saying you go out and do this. And you might put some standards on it, but then you are no longer involved. That's not what's happening here at all.
Well, I am not involved. Sure, I'm involved. I might take a percent of rents over a particular amount of money. I mean, I could put in a lot of provisions that do that. I'm as involved as the city is involved, and that's exactly what the city is doing now. It's saying, I don't need to contract out for the services. I'm going to hire my own employees, and that's what the apartment owner can do.
But Your Honor, I don't think that the city has the same lack of involvement. If you look under the promotion of what they're doing here, first of all, on the bottom of the first page, it says the park superintendent and the golf pro shall cooperate each with the other to promote the efficient use of the golf course.
I'll put in the same contract in property management. I have no problem with that.
Under the promotion, they're not only contributing to the advertising, 100% of the advertising.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
I'll put that in.
Putting in, giving away services for free to bring golfers in.
Perfectly okay in my contract. I'm willing to put that in.
Okay. And then you've got where not only is the landlord receiving money from the tenant in some fashion, but the landlord is also receiving money, revenue, based on the property manager's goods and services.
Well, that's because I have a concession in the building. I've got a coffee shop, and I'm going to take a percent of that, too, as the owner, but that you can, the rental management can deal with that. I'm putting it in the exact same terms.
It's not exactly the
same. They cannot golf on the small lawn. That's the only thing I'm going to put in.
They can't do what?
Golf.
Okay.
On my property.
Okay. Well, I think that what you're saying is you keep adding elements, then you are starting to get it to a dealership, and that's the point.
I think those elements are in real estate deals.
Well, this contract specifically says in two places it's not a real estate deal, and they make the exact
That's fine. I'm going to put in it's not a real estate deal either. It's just a management service contract.
Okay.
Counselor, if these folks wanted sell their skills,
Have I made my property management company into a dealership?
So the issue is the property manager also receiving an additional percentage of the other landlord's income in terms of what they're doing?
Oh, we can put all of these properties together if you want.
Once you do that, once you add those elements, then under the Ziegler totality of circumstances test, you might get there. But if you talk about a normal landlord-tenant property manager relationship, you're not even close to there, is what my position is, Your Honor.
I think it is normal.
Okay. I was curious about the property manager, if he gets fired by the owner of one building, can just go to another building and offer his services and set up and manage that building. But these golf pros, without a golf course, what do they have?
They don't. In fact, they're forced to, you talk about the risk of loss, they were forced to fire sale all their stuff. The city of Madison didn't make its decision until December, and they had to be out by the end of December. So they had to sell everything off. They couldn't reanimate it. You know, they had the golf range. Justice Gableman was talking about the other services. The golf range, the pickers, the balls, everything had to be sold off, including the motorized carts.
Well, there are golf courses outside of Madison.
Yes, there are, Your Honor. And so could they...
And that may other part of the question is the fact that they might have to go somewhere else than Madison, is that a criteria in the dealership law?
I don't think that's any different than saying if you've got a Wendy's franchise and you terminate the franchisee and don't give notice and say, but you can go, you know, you can go out of the city and start a Hardee's franchise.
I think that's very different.
Are you finished with your question?
You think, okay.
Yeah, no, I'm done.
Well,
I'm not going to interject unless you're finished answering.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead,
Your Honor. I say, holy cow. I don't know the difference between the arrangement here, other than this is a municipality, and of course that brings in this case its own issues. Is it a person and the whole immunity and all of those issues? But if we rule in your favor, won't this have broad implications for all sorts of private golf courses around the state?
Well, most golf courses hire employees to manage their golf courses. There are some that hire services, independent contractors, to manage a number of courses. I don't have any experience or knowledge of anything that's close to this in terms of the contributing money to a joint advertising fund, co-promotion, giving the free services, that type of stuff doesn't exist.
Would it be correct to say that you don't know one way or the other when you say you don't have knowledge of? What I am interested in knowing, and if the record supports, how this case would affect those other entities. And so perhaps you don't know, and that's okay. Or another way of saying it is, I don't know of anyone that would be affected, which suggests that none would be affected. I just want to know, does anyone know how this ruling will affect a myriad of private golf courses around the state?
It will not affect them, Your Honor.
And why not?
Because the other arrangements in terms of managing golf courses don't approach the arrangement that the city has with the former golf course.
And that answer then means you're telling me that you're familiar with other arrangements throughout the state. Is that part of the record?
It is not, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Members of the court, good morning. I'm Paul Norman. I'm appearing on behalf of the defendant respondent, City of Madison. I will be addressing the issues relating to whether the contracts between the golf pros and the city was a dealership under the fair dealership law. My co-counsel, Kathy Rotier, will be addressing other issues. I want to focus on the right to sell or distribute goods or services element. The only good or service that's been identified as a potential city service or good that's involved in this is the right to access to the golf course. So the question...
What do you make of the line in the Court of Appeals opinion? I asked your opposing counsel, I want to ask you, why is that so abstract?
As to whether it's a service...
They didn't.
Yeah, I don't think they relied on.
They didn't attach the word to the element. They just said, well, in the abstract, it could possibly be. No, they were puzzling over. They were puzzling over whether it was the sale of a good or service. And I don't understand what is so abstract about the concept of selling the right to temporarily use a golf course.
Well, I believe the Court of Appeals, while they questioned whether it was a service, their decision really rested on the fact that the involvement of the golf pros in the sale of the right to access to the golf course was not sufficient to constitute selling within the meaning of the statute. And the way they got there was the fact...
Oh, please go ahead.
Based on the facts that the city set the golf... The amount, the green fees, the season passes, the two items that represented the right to access. All the golf pros did was when players came in to play golf, they collected the fee, they put it in the till, they went directly to the city, they collected no percentage of that amount.
And when I read that in your brief, the thought I had was, well, gee, isn't that a little like saying the McDonald's franchisee, all the franchisee does is collect the money for the hamburger and then pass the hamburger out?
Well, a McDonald's franchisee comes in their dealership because they are using the McDonald's trademark. They meet the second prong. I'm not sure a McDonald's franchisee sells any good or service of McDonald's. But they do use the trademark, so they obviously come under the second element. But you got to look at both prongs here, and did either prong exist? And focusing on the right to sell a city service is simply collecting the payment set by the alleged grantor for that service and turning 100% of that over. Is that enough to constitute selling a grantor service? And I say no.
Right. You say no, and that's very clear. What would be enough, what would have to change about the factors that you just listed to make the answer be yes?
I think the Bush case makes a good example. There, Bush was allowed to go out and actually negotiate the terms of the sale with the students or their parents for the portrait. Bush had the discretion to set the price and could, in the words of this court, commit the defendant in that case to the sale at the price that Bush decided. That constituted selling. Contrast that with the Forster decision, where you had a manufacturer's rep who went out, he solicited people, he got them to come to buy it, but he did not negotiate the terms of the sale. And this court in Forster, one of the early decisions under the fair dealership law, said that's not sufficient to constitute selling. You've got to be in a position to bind the principal, the alleged grantor, to the terms of a sale. That didn't exist here. If you were to say that's enough to constitute the right to grant of the right to sell, then you are bringing in a whole bunch of relationships where people hire independent contractors to help run their business and as part of that collect the proceeds for whatever goods or services the grantor is selling. But you would end up extending this law far beyond where the legislature
Well, counsel, this is a little bit more than just selling access to the golf course, isn't it? The contract required the golf pros to provide a complete golf experience. That is to say, you were not running a golf mall where you had a building in which one part of the building you were selling greens fees, and then you had a McDonald's over here, and then down at the other end of the mall you had a Golf Galaxy shop and then a golf tech lesson center somewhere else in the building. You went to the golf pros and said, you put this together as a seamless package presentation of a golf experience to Madison golfers, right?
Was the fact that the golf pros under the contract were paid to provide operational services, does that all of a sudden convert this collection of into the sale of the access?
Well, I want to focus on the totality of what you to do. They weren't there just to collect greens fees from you, right? They weren't employees in that sense. What you wanted them to do was make this look like, well, for lack of a better term, a good high-end private golf course, right, with all of the natural amenities and services and whatnot that you would get at a high-end golf course, right?
The golf pros were retained under the contract. The primary purpose of the contract was to hire the golf pros as independent contractors to operate the golf courses for the city of Madison. They were paid a flat fee for that. And very similar to the Court of Appeals decisions or the Kenya decision by this court, where someone hires an independent contractor to provide services. The rulings up to now by this court and the Court of Appeals below has been that is not selling a city of the grantor, or service of the grantor, that is selling the alleged dealer services to the grantor. And that doesn't constitute a dealership. Otherwise, again, you'd be bringing in all of these. Any business owner who hires an independent contractor to help conduct the business and pays them for those services would all of a sudden be establishing a permanent relationship.
You argued that, of course, your argument right now is paralleling that in your brief, where you also put a lot of heavy emphasis on what was referred to as the retainers. It ranged from about $22,000 a year, I think, to $44,500 a year. My recollection. And you put a lot of emphasis on that in a couple of different contexts. But whenever you did that, the thought that came to my mind was, well, what about the commission? What about the percentages of the sales that they were able to keep from the cart and club rentals, from the sales at the for food and beverages, for the 100% for the golf lessons? And doesn't that create a differentiation between the person who is simply paid to hand out tickets for admission in exchange for a preset price?
There was clearly two aspects to this contract. One was the city retaining the service of the golf pros to operate the golf course and paying them the retainer or flat fee.
Was
amount.
The retainer? And then, I don't remember the retainer, though. Was the retainer directly linked to this retainer is to reimburse you for collecting the fees for the green fees?
It would have included the collecting of the green fees, the operation, helping, making sure play was orderly, letting the people
right,
on
but
the course.
It was part of the whole
that was
contract.
All that, yeah.
Okay, I just want to make it that clear, because it sounded like you were trying to make it sound like they were glorified ticket takers getting paid a little bit more with a direct link, a nexus between the payment of the retainer simply for collecting the money for the greens fees.
No, they were paid the retainer.
I did not recall that from the contract.
They were paid the retainer for all of the services they provided for
right.
the city, but their only involvement in the transaction involving access to the course was collecting the fees. The sale of that access was collecting the fees. They did not set the price
why
or any other term.
Why does that matter, Council? Why does it matter that they did not set the price for the greens fee?
I'm sorry.
Why does it matter that the golf pros did not set the greens fee? It just seems to me that just means that's not a profit center for them. Why does that go to whether or not they were selling the city's access to the golf course?
Because I think it's very important under both the Bush and Ziegler line of cases is that selling involves some control over the terms of the sale, not simply collecting the fees, and that's why is important.
This had complete control. Nobody's getting into a Madison golf course without going through the golf pros, right?
Say that again. I'm sorry.
Nobody's getting into a Madison golf course without going through the golf pros, right? They controlled access 100%.
They were the only one on the golf course that would collect the fee and allow the players on the course,
okay.
which they were hired by the city to do.
Right.
Council, I'd like to shift your focus a little bit to the golf carts because they were required by the contract and the golf pros had to purchase them. They were required by the city so that folks could rent them if they chose when they played golf. But the pros set the price for the rental.
Right.
And they remitted then of that rental, I think 15% of the rentals back to the city, correct?
Yes, as I said.
So they did more than just collect green fees. They provided access to the court, to the course, in the way that the city described in the contract, so that people could ride rather than walk, correct?
Right. There was two, as I said, there's two aspects to this agreement, and I think you have to look at them separately. Certainly, if they were two different contracts, you would be looking at them separately. The fact that they were combined in one shouldn't make a difference for purposes of the analysis here. As part of this contract, the golf pros had the right to use the city courses to operate a concession business. That included the rental of golf carts, the sale of golf merchandise, the sale of food and beverages. They paid a percentage of those revenues to the city for the right to use the city's premises to operate these businesses, which were the golf pros' businesses, on it. Had this been done as part of a lease arrangement, there would be no question that this involved a dealership at all. But because it was somehow combined in this contract, and that's where Attorney Palmershine gets into this package of services. But this is no different than any other business owner deciding that there might be another business that could occupy the space that they operate. Example would be a bowling alley owner. And they say, you know, a lot of more people want to bowl if they can eat pizza and drink beer while they're bowling, and therefore I'm going to rent this space or a portion of the space to a pizza franchisee to operate that business, and I'll have them pay me a percentage of the revenues to compensate me as rent, so to speak. That wouldn't create a dealership.
But what if they also bought the bowling pins and the bowling balls?
Pardon?
What if this service provider, as you call it, also, in addition to providing food and drink, also provided the bowling pins and the bowling balls?
Well, if they were selling that as part of the pizza franchisee, that might be, but the golf course itself, the bowling balls, yes, they could be part of the rental of a concession, but that wouldn't, again, make it a dealership. If they're acquiring all of these goods and services are sold through the golf pros business or concession businesses, were acquired from other sources. They bought nothing from the city other than the right to use the space. And to say that those become somehow the city's goods or services, I don't see how you can reach that conclusion. Again, the question is, if you were to apply the fair dealership law to this case, you would be bringing in a lot of independent contractor relationships between business owners and independent contractors. Legislature was ever intended to cover.
Mr. Norman, give me an example of a business with an independent contractor that would be brought in. I tried for property management.
Well, we
could take the bowling alley, and I have the bowling alley. I own the bowling alley. I don't want to run it, so I hire you as an independent contractor to run the bowling alley, and I'll fix the price for this. I will maintain the alleys, which have to be maintained, and you are to provide and keep the equipment in order, the bowling balls and the pins and the setup. Is that going to be a franchise?
You certainly would be going that route, particularly if, as part of that, you also said, as you know, that also we will allow you to use the bowling alley to sell pizza and beer, along with paying you to help operate or to operate the bowling alley. Now you would be under the facts of this case. The next case come along of that situation, you would have to find that a dealership as well.
But you don't think it's a dealership.
Huh?
But you wouldn't say it's a dealership.
No, because
it's the same example.
I don't think it's a dealership here, and I don't think that should be a dealership, and I don't think the legislature ever intended that to be
covered. So I want
covered.
You to tell me if we've held for the plaintiffs, the golf pros here, what are the consequences? Give me some other examples that might then become dealerships. What about the prison?
The prison?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have to get away from the question of sovereign immunity, but
other than that.
Yeah. Yes, I mean, I think whether you're talking about a government or a private owner, if you hire under the contention the plaintiffs are making in this case, if you were to, any business owner hires an independent contractor, allows them to collect the fees for whatever goods or services the business owner is selling through that, and just to bring this other aspect of the concession businesses in, allow them to operate their own business on your premises, or maybe that's not even necessary, just the one hiring them, according to the plaintiffs, you have granted them the right to sell your goods and services because you're collecting the fees, even though you've set those.
Counsel, I'd like to bring you back to this case, not a hypothetical, and I'm very interested in the golf carts. The golf carts are used to facilitate access to the golf course. They are required by the contract. Why isn't that a sale of a service the city is providing to the public, not directly, but through the golf pros?
Because the golf carts are not acquired from the city. The golf carts are acquired from
But the city requires
sources.
Them. I understand that directly it is the golf pro that says, this is what it costs and you pay me to rent this cart. I get that. But also in the contract, it is required by the city that there be golf carts to facilitate access to the city's course. Why isn't that a service that the city, that the golf pros are selling on behalf of the city?
Because I don't think that the city is in the business of selling golf carts or renting golf carts.
Well, they require it in the contract. The question I'm asking you and what's bothering me is this. Does the sale have to be direct? Or can it be through an agent of the city and still be selling a service on behalf of the city? That's the legal question that's bothering me. That's why I focus on the golf carts, okay?
I don't think of the rental of golf carts or the sale of a golf cart or a golf clubs as to being a service. I think you're talking about a good there.
All right, well, say a good. I don't care the label. It's okay. Goods or services in the statute. I'm trying to see, do you have to do it directly, or can it be done through an agent and still be a sale on behalf of the city of whatever goods or services?
Certainly you can sell stuff through an agent. There's no question about that.
Okay.
That's what the city was doing with the access to golf, with the golf course itself.
Well, and that's what you're doing with everything, right?
Hmm?
That's what you were doing with everything. Without the golf, it strikes me that without the golf pros, you don't actually have a golf course. You've got a bunch of grass with a dozen and a half holes in it, right? The golf pros come along, they give you, and they would actually provide the golf course. When people go to golf, they expect to do more than walk onto a piece of property that has holes on it, right? They expect there to be a clubhouse. They expect there to be carts, as Justice Burdensack was speaking of. They expect that there's going to be food and beverage. They expect there's going to be golf pros and lessons and all the other things that go into the experience of a golf outing. And that's what the golf pros provided. And that's what you required, right? You, by contract, you required them to essentially provide a golf course that they could then promote and sell in conjunction with the city.
Well, the city had the golf course. They had the greens and stuff like that. In fact, they maintained
it. You had land with 18 holes in it. That's what you had.
They wanted to add to the golf course a concession business, so they retained the city or agreed with the golf pros to allow them, in fact, obligate them because they saw some advantage to themselves to do it, to operate. But that business was not a city good or service. That was the golf pro's good or service.
Come now, Counselor. You,
the same
you,
way that...
Can I take a flyer here and assume that you golf?
Say that again?
Can I take a flyer here and assume that you golf?
I do golf very badly and very occasionally.
I'm sure you golf better than I do. So when you go to golf, you're looking for more than a piece of property with a hole in it, right?
When I play golf?
Yes.
I really never thought of it one way or the other. When I play golf, I take my clubs, I go, I play. I might, if there's a concession there, I might buy a hamburger or a beer at the end of the course.
You might use golf carts, perhaps, on occasion.
I have used golf carts.
Yeah. Okay. And maybe if you arrive short a few golf balls, you might pick a few up.
I'm sorry.
If you arrive at the course short a few golf balls, maybe you buy a couple while you're there.
Certainly, yeah.
Maybe a golf glove.
Right.
A cap if you forgot one. Right. This all goes part.
And all
this
that,
is all,
yes.
It's all part of the golfing experience, right?
Right. And there are other issues that are going to be addressed. By
yes,
and
my time
here.
Is up, and I would like to reserve some time.
I know you
would.
Thank you. We just like the argument so much. We get very involved. So thank you.
Thank you, members of the court. My name is Kathy Rochier, and along with Paul Norman, I'm representing the city of Madison here. As you know, both lower courts dismissed the Gulf Pro's fair dealership claims against the city after finding that the second essential element of a dealership claim was not satisfied by the facts of record. If the court concurs with that analysis of the courts below, there's no need to go further to identify further reasons to affirm the judgment of dismissal. But the fact of the matter is that there are other reasons, and I want to talk about them because I think they are dispositive.
Before you do, Ms. Rochier, is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision you think is an error?
Is there anything about the Court of Appeals decision that I think is an error?
That you would change?
If
this is on the substance, and then you can talk about the extra issues.
No, I don't believe so. Nothing comes to my mind that I thought, gee, they got that wrong when they were making an argument. They went down some paths I might not have, but they're the court and I'm not. So
none of the paths bothered you as bad.
No.
Contrary to the law.
No. I think they understood the distinction between a right to sell, as in a right to sell the ability to park a car in a parking lot, which requires judgment and requires management skills and requires getting the vehicle from the far back out when the first person wants to leave and all sorts of other things. It never creates a dealership, much like the right to play golf does not create a dealership. But I need to talk about those other reasons.
You need to go to the other issues, please.
And I want to talk mostly about the one that I think is the most straightforward way of resolving this case. And it relates to the first element of a dealership, which requires that there be a contract between two or more persons. Persons is a defined term under the fair dealership law. And if the city of Madison does not constitute a person for purposes of that law, then the first element can never be satisfied. The city is never subject to the fair dealership law, and the case is over.
I was delighted that you went to Chapter 990 for the definition. Oftentimes, practitioners forget about our 990, and of course, a 990 is set forth in your brief. It defines person as including a body politic.
Right.
And you make that distinction in your brief compared to the definition under the Fair Dealership Act.
Here's my take on how the court should reach the conclusion that the definition of person in the dealership law should not be construed so broadly as to include the city. The statutory definition in Section 135.02 sub 6 states that person means a natural person, partnership, joint venture, corporation, or other entity. That is it. That is the totality of the definition of person. Now, I agree, because I'm not an idiot, that the city is a municipal corporation, and the city could fit within the very flexible and undefined category of other entity. Pretty much anything or anyone could. But that's not enough. And the reason it's not enough, I will show you, is based on four reasons. First, there's absolutely no legislative history anywhere, and we searched high and low, that suggests legislatures who enacted this statute in the early 1970s ever intended the dealership law to apply so broadly as to bring municipal governments within its sweep. If there had been such intent, one would expect to find some mention somewhere, but there is nothing. So that's the first telltale sign that this dealership law does not apply to municipalities. The second reason, and I think this one is the big kahuna, this is the best one, derives from Section 62.11 sub 5 the home rule statute that defines the power of a city, like the city of Madison. The full text of that section is on page 37 of the city's brief. It's only two sentences, but the section is actually fairly long because the first sentence is very long. It describes the power of the city very broadly. The city has power to do budgetary matters, financial matters, control property, control the health, welfare, and safety of its citizens, to help in commercial matters, to do budgetary concerns. All of those powers are incorporated within 62.115. There is a very important beginning conditional phrase on that description of the broadness of the city's powers, and it says, except as elsewhere in the statutes specifically provided. And I'm putting a lot of emphasis on that word specifically. There is absolutely nothing in the fair dealership law that is specific to municipalities. And if the legislature wanted, by the enactment of the fair dealership law, to inhibit the city of Madison's ability to contract and figure out how they wanted to handle their golf course management, how they wanted to make budgetary considerations, they could have specifically said so, and they did not.
Counsel, doesn't that go more to the question of governmental immunity rather than to whether this definition is broad enough to encompass a municipality?
I don't think so, Justice Kelly, and the reason is that this section, 62.115, has two cautionary phrases. The first one, which I've just talked about, that talks about to limit these powers, you have to be specific. And the last sentence of that very same passage says that all these powers, which are now defined, can be limited only by express language. That's the legislature's choice of wording. So you need to have express language to limit the city's powers that are defined by that statute. And there's nowhere in the fair dealership law that such express language
right.
exists.
But these express powers are the powers incident to being a municipal entity, right? And what we're talking about here is the municipality acting as a competitor in the marketplace. And those are two different things, aren't they?
Actually not. I know that Attorney Palmersheim argued that, but I will tell you, if you look at the record in this case, there is nowhere where there was a discussion of the city becoming a competitor with private businesses.
Well,
the fact of the matter...
But aren't they?
I'm sorry?
Aren't they?
They want people to come to city golf courses because they want to make the golf courses available to the public, and the only way that makes financial sense is if people go there, spend money, so that the city can collect that money and put it into more maintenance and more capital improvements of the golf club houses over time.
And Madison wants people to go to Madison's golf courses as opposed to someone else's golf courses, right?
Well, sure. I mean, you want people to come to what you have to offer. Otherwise, what you have to offer is going to go to waste. It's going to be underfunded, and you're not going to be able to continue it.
Right.
So that isn't good.
Isn't that pretty much the definition of being in competition with private golf courses?
I'm not sure that I would agree that fits the definition of being in competition, but if you're saying anybody who wants somebody to go to your house as opposed to your neighbor's house, that's in competition, yes. I guess we want people to come to the golf courses. We want it to be a good experience, that's for sure. But I will tell you that in 6211, the statute that I'm relying on, it does say that the city can act for the city's commercial benefit. There isn't any restriction on the city's ability to do that. And if the legislature wants to stop that, the legislature has to use express language to do so, and they simply have not done
that. Counselor, I'd like to draw your attention to 135.07. It talks about the applicability of the dealership law, and there are some folks listed, some businesses listed, and some modes of doing business that are listed, but there's nothing in here about saying that a municipality is excluded. If that's the case and your argument is correct, they're not a, quote, person, so they don't fall under the first section, why aren't they listed as someone
Because nobody thought about it.
Nobody in the world dreamed that this is ever going to apply to a municipality. They didn't list a convent and nuns either, but they never thought it was going to apply to them either. So they didn't put it in there.
Let's have your third and fourth point.
Okay. Sorry about that. This business about what it means to express reference, I want to just cite a couple of cases for you on that. Fox v. City of Racine, 1937 case, specifically about 6211. It says that express language means express reference. There is none in the fair dealership law. This court just recently decided a Wisconsin Carey case and decided it not favorably to the city of Madison, so I don't cite it joyfully, but in that case, paragraph 64, this court said expressly means you say it, and they didn't say it. There's nothing express about the fair dealership law that brings cities within its compass.
Counsel, what tools of construction would you have us use to determine whether entity is supposed to be construed broadly or narrowly?
Well, I cited in the brief the rule of construction that was cited in the DNR v. City of Waukesha case, which says generic statutes which can be read to apply to municipalities or their governmental entities or to private parties or both should be construed not to apply to governmental entities unless the circumstances require that result. Now, I understand and I agree that DNR then goes on to say that rule of construction is being relaxed and you apply statutes more broadly if the purpose of the statute couldn't be satisfied without including the city or another governmental entity within its compass. Here, that factor doesn't apply. The fair dealership law can go on just fine without including a municipality within its compass. And also, that rule of construction says you don't apply a generic statute to a municipality if doing so would interfere with vital functions of the city. And here it absolutely would. You have no, well, it is a chilling thing to say to the city, anytime you make a contract with a service provider at a ski hill, at a skating rink, at the Olbrich Gardens, at any of the features that make Madison, Madison, you run the risk of having a perpetual contract because you've created a dealership you didn't know you created, and you are stuck
with
it forever.
But that's not true, actually, Council. It doesn't create a perpetual contract. It just requires the grantor, in this case, potentially the city, to provide notice and have good cause to alter or terminate the arrangement. And the case law makes clear that the circumstances the city was facing here, arguably economic duress, this doesn't make financial sense for the city, constitutes good cause. It just requires the city to demonstrate those factors.
The problem, though, is that the city has to have a budget every single year. That's under Chapter 65. And there are fairly elaborate rules on what the city's budgetary process needs to be. Here you're layering another group of requirements. There's a 90-day notice period and then a 60-day period where deficiencies can be corrected. And if they're corrected, then the notice is void. That messes with the budgetary process significantly for a city of the size of the city of Madison. And so it is an interference with its ability to do the natural things it needs to do to have a yearly budget process. I haven't gotten to the other two reasons, which are statute of limitations and governmental immunity. You know, there's been so much decisions from members, current members of the court and former members of the court about governmental immunity and what it should encompass. But everybody seems to agree we should go back to the language of the statute itself, which provides immunity for acts done in the exercise of legislative, quasi-legislative, judicial, or quasi-judicial powers. There is nothing more legislative than the City of Madison acting through its Common Council and the Mayor, making a budgetary determination that the golf course operation should be changed. If there is any decision that should be subject to governmental immunity, this is it. With respect to the statute of limitations, it's so fact-intensive that my red light is on and I don't wish to overstay my welcome, but it's only a one-year statute of limitations. They were told in August that the city was going to make substantial changes, August of 2012, in the relationship. The contracts ended at the end of December. 2012. They didn't file suit until mid-January 2014. That's way more than the year that's allowed by Section 893.93. The only way they can even hope to get past the statute of limitations is by arguing that they get the benefit of the 120-day float period created by the notice of claim statute as described in the Colby case, and then also to say their timeline for the cause of action accruing does not begin until October, when they were told definitively that the contracts would not be renewed. That's not consonant with Wisconsin case law, specifically the Ziegler v. Lear case and the Lemoyne case, both of which say that once you know there's going to be a substantial change in what you claim as a dealership, you have a cause of action and can seek injunctive relief right then, right there. And they had that knowledge back in August of 2012. They didn't bring suit until January of 2014. The claim is barred, and once it's barred forever. It creates a right on behalf of the defendant to be free forever of the claim. It is a very big deal, and it should not be overlooked by this court.
Thank you very much. As you begin, Counselor, I would like you to address some of the things that Attorney Rotier brought up, because the other parts of our argument have all focused on whether there is a dealership.
Well, I think, you know, the finishing off on the notice of claim part of it, the DNR Waukesha case, I think, handles a couple of those issues. That talked about, quote, the additional burden is not likely to bring the wheels of state government to a halt on whether or not there needed to be a notice of claim in a governmental entity, state giving a notice to a city. And, you know, that goes to what Justice Rebecca Bradley was questioning on, too, on the requirements imposed on the city does not bring city government to a halt, does not interfere. They can establish good cause and terminate a dealership just like anybody else can.
Counsel, I'd rather have you focus on the statute of limitations. My understanding from your brief is that you said you didn't know till October 12, 2012. You didn't file until January of 2014. What's your best argument about why that's okay?
There was no claim that could have been brought on August 2nd, 2012.
I'm not saying August 2nd. Your brief said October 12, 2012. That's what your brief says. That's not what opposing counsel argued. 1 year statute of limitation, why is it not gone on October 11, 2013?
Because it's extended by 120 days by virtue of the notice of claim statute.
What's your case that says that?
That you have to give a notice of claim. The most recent case is the easy roll-off case, which states that you have to provide a notice of claim to a city or a government before you're allowed to commence a suit, and that case states that notice of claim, which is 120 days, extends the statute of limitations.
Thank you.
So if it's a one-year statute, it turns to a 1 year and 120
days. 20 days, okay.
And I'm sorry, I was talking about that. They couldn't have done anything before then.
I just want to focus on what she said, because I thought she made some powerful arguments, and you haven't had a chance to express your side orally.
And, you know, and that is an issue, too, that, I mean, the circuit court found that there was not a statute of limitations issue. They said that the city has to convey notice that they're terminating, not hint broadly. So that issue was decided in our favor on that.
Well, that's why I got the October 12th date. That came on the brief.
Is the city a municipal corporation?
Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And I think that my colleague conceded that fact. It is. And, you know, and going back to what Justice Ann Walsh Bradley was talking about with Chapter 990, you know, the 01 on the definitions, that definition of person it just says the word person includes. It doesn't say that means. So it says it includes. In fact, if you look at that definition under that statute, it doesn't even mention a natural person. So it's just saying when you construe statutes, you shouldn't construe it to mean a body politic unless the statute itself or the legislative intent is different.
There are other statutes that bring into their foray a body politic, or sometimes they use the language subdivision of the state, governmental subdivision, including, you know, towns, villages, et cetera. And you don't have that here. Antitrust is another example where there is reference to
essentially a body politic, a governmental entity, not here.
Well, in fact, the antitrust under Chapter 133, and that has a long paragraph definition and includes a long list of things. Not all statutes do that. The statute that we have under fair dealership, for example, doesn't mention limited liability companies. But it would certainly apply to limited liability companies. That's why they just say, hey, we're going to say corporations and other entities to include it. And then we have Chapter 990 that says, hey, if we don't have anything inconsistent, the word person includes bodies politic. So I think the argument made by the city on Chapter 990.01 actually favors the golf pros, doesn't hurt them.
Well, other entity is limited to the series stated that are similar, and nothing about that series deals with government entities. But it does deal with corporations, and a limited liability corporation is similar to a corporation.
Well, that's
other
why,
entity
why
does not broaden this outside of everything.
The word entity doesn't?
Other entity, no, it doesn't. The concept, the canon of construction is eustem generis. It means things that are similar when you add in a general description after a series of descriptions.
Well, the word entity would be a little broader than that, I would think, Your Honor. Again, I use the limited liability company. It's
that's
not
right.
Similar to...
Similar to corporation. Well, you should get extra time because they got extra time.
Well, I wanted to...
Please, just make a brief concluding statement. Thank you.
Trying to characterize this as very simple, all they're doing is collecting fees. And the analogy I would use on this is this would be the difference between charging somebody an admission to go into a restaurant to watch a cooking show and charging a fee to go into a restaurant, sit down, get a menu, being told the specials of the day, getting served your food by all the servers, and getting to eat it. And I know we're getting to the lunch hour, and I would say to you, Your Honors, that the difference between going in and watching somebody eat and actually getting to eat yourself, while both satisfying, are two very different things.
Very good. Thank you very much. Thank you for a very, very interesting argument, and thank you for bringing this case to us. It's just fascinating. I've been a judge for a long time now, since 96, and I think this is the first time that people have really taken on fair dealership in the way that you all have. Was well briefed and very well argued. So thank you all very much. We're going to take a break, and we have our third case at 1:30, so we are adjourned.
Thanks.